Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
If you want to make sense of what the Trump administration is going to mean for land in the West, you need to understand a few things. The first is the president's vision to establish energy dominance, and we'll come back to that a little bit later. But the other thing to understand is this moment in history, a turning point in the West. It was called the Sagebrush Rebellion. It was this conservative movement that took hold in the 1970s and 80s that challenged the federal government's management of the vast swath of public land. But before we get there, let's go back even further to the time when the American frontier was still open and the country's leaders were trying to draw settlers west. Dan McCool is a scholar of the West, and he's going to take us through this history.
This was a time when they wanted to make it very easy for people to move out west and access the resources by subsidizing them. And a lot of people showed up. And by 1890, the frontier was gone. But these giveaway programs, a lot of them remained on the books. And that really formed the mentality of both the government and the people living out west, that the job of the government was to provide resources, land, water, forage, timber. And in 1946, the General Land Office was combined with a couple of other smaller agencies to form the Bureau of Land Management. And its clientele was miners and ranchers. That's who was interested, and that's who accessed the public domain lands. And they basically had total control over it. So this developed a prevailing ethos among ranchers and timber companies and other extractive resources that public lands were really lands available to them exclusively to do what they wanted. And they did. And it was not until 1976 that all of that policy changed with the passage of the Federal Land Policy and Management Act.
And that fundamentally changed the mission of the BLM.
First of all, it abandoned the policy that the government was going to dispose of federal lands out west. And instead it said, we will maintain these lands for public use and enjoyment and for the public good. And then it brought in new constituencies and new purposes, including recreation and a greater emphasis on preserving biological diversity, preserving water resources. And all of a sudden, the list of people who are competing for the land got much longer. And ranchers were now fighting for a resource with a significant number of other groups of people. And, well, they organized. And the Sagebrush Rebellion is basically the nickname for groups of people who got together and wanted to oppose all of those changes in land management. And the Sagebrush Rebels formed local groups, they formed national groups, they developed a national constituency among other groups that didn't like some of the changes. I've interviewed ranchers who are wonderful people. I've never met a rancher I didn't like. And one just said, I know this land's not mine where my cattle graze, but it feels like it's my land. And I understand his perception on that. For most of his life, he could do whatever he wanted with that land. The policy favored him. And if there's one rule in politics, it's that once you distribute goodies, rights or privileges or subsidies or services, it is very difficult to ever try to remove that right. So I can understand that.
This brings us to today, the Trump administration. They even have a couple of sagebrush rebels in the administration. But sometimes the Trump administration's goal of more extractive industries, of mining, gas and oil drilling, comes into conflict with ranchers. So there's not a precise match between the original goals of the sagebrush rebels and the Trump administration. The sagebrush rebels are interested in going back to the days of rancher control over vast swaths of public lands. But the Trump administration wants to see dramatic increases in oil and gas drilling and mining. So we may see conflicts between those two groups in the coming years.
The problem is the population, the economy of the West have changed dramatically. And a West that used to be focused on agriculture and ranching is now completely dominated by service economies, high-tech economies, and tourism and recreation. So we have a whole new ballgame now, a whole new economy, and we have to change the policy to meet reality.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's what we're going to try and get at today. How will the West change under the Trump administration, if it does? If you look at Trump's first term, there are the clues. He significantly reduced the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. He rolled back more than 100 environmental protections for climate and water and wildlife. And already, he's dismantled renewable energy policies and opened up more land for oil and gas lease sales. But a larger transformation is probably still taking shape. Joining us first is the journalist Hal Herring. Herring is a contributing editor to Field & Stream magazine. He hosts a podcast about hunting and fishing on public land, and he's working on a book about public land in the country. Now, the first question we asked was whether Herring thought Donald Trump really thinks all that much about land issues in the West.
The president is a real estate developer and an international businessman. He has been very honest about that he's not an outdoors person, you know. So I doubt it, except as it plays into politics. And, of course, as we've seen, unfortunately, it has become a political both football and flashpoint, right?
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody who's more attuned than President Trump to political flashpoints. In that way, I'm sure he's cognizant of this debate as it relates to the politics that empowers him.
So we'll talk about someone else who might be influencing him, but maybe say something about his son. His son is an outdoors person and may have at least some influence on the way, if he's thinking about it at all.
Absolutely. And I think that if he's thinking about it at all is the first question,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on, and this is not to somebody who's a president right now the most pressing issue in the nation or the globe. So it might be to me and you though, right? Like this is my home, my backyard, my life. But to others, that not so much. I think that Donald Trump Jr. is an outdoors person and does understand the especially like hunters. How those lands are important in the West, especially. And I do think he can bring that information to his father, no doubt. But once again, for the very wealthy folks out there, the national forests and the BLM lands are not as necessary as they are to the rank and file outdoors person anywhere in America. I think of how many people travel to Utah every spring just to do desert trip.
Yeah.
To them, there's no plan B, right? Although I think Donald Jr. is capable of understanding that. I think we should be honest that he has less incentive or motivation to speak for all of those of us who don't have access to vast private lands.
So if Stephen Miller is the Trump advisor informing the president on immigration, who's the Stephen Miller on land in the West? Is there one?
So I don't think it's become important enough. I mean, the first answer to that would be Kevin Roberts from Heritage. And I doubt that there is a lands whisperer there at this moment. And if it is, it's kind of a cacophony of voices that date back to the anti-public lands privatization movement, Sagebrush Rebellion, because this has become part of, and I'm using air quotes here, conservative ideology in the United States. I think it's time to say this, that there was a propaganda campaign, and recently my mother-in-law, who's much older, obviously, she said that this campaign has been going on since FDR. But there's been a campaign in my adult life, since Ronald Reagan, to convince Americans that the federal government was this boogeyman and that the public lands were a manifestation of this boogeyman in our lives. And I got to say, that propaganda campaign, it seems to have succeeded for now. And this is kind of amazing to me because it has succeeded at the same time that more and more people are loving and using the American public lands. And I don't call it a propaganda war, because there wasn't anybody on the other side making up fairy tales about the evilness of privatization, for instance. We'd ever really considered it. But there has been an ongoing propaganda campaign that somehow these federal lands are a manifestation of terrible presence and tyranny in our own lives, even as we're free to use them. It's very odd. It might be a specifically American thing, you know, where you've lived this life of really wonderful freedom and kind of privilege, and so you kind of forget how you got it.
Yeah. I guess I kind of figured where you might be headed with that question of the lands whisperer was William Perry Pendley, because his name does come up. Tell us about him anyway, and where he might fit in the picture.
Well, Mr. Pendley comes, you know, he comes out of Mountain States Legal Foundation, which was James Watts. If anybody remembers the Reagan Interior Secretary, who eventually resigned after some scandals. Perry also was in that administration. We are going back to like 1980. Those ideas that are straight out of the early Reagan administration, they're 45 years old, and they haven't changed a bit, even as the country has changed immeasurably, and the expectations of Americans of our own public lands. So Mr. Pendley is sort of this old kind of fossilized anti-federal government, Western kind of, I don't know what you call it. It's not mythology. It's an ideology. It's a fossilized ideology. I mean, I find it absolutely impossible to imagine that Doug Burgum of North Dakota, who's the Secretary of Interior now, is particularly interested in a 45-year-old take on extractive industry on the public lands.
So, Hal, it sounds like what you're saying is that this old fossil, as you put it, William Perry Pendley, represents this dated viewpoint that you don't think or possibly won't hold sway with this Trump administration. Is that right?
Well, I think that it will hold sway as long as it's not contested. Yeah. I mean, you know, Mr. Pendley's view is kind of the same view people had in 1876 when they were shooting the last bison, right? And that's a very American, right? Like William Clark in Montana, mining everything and cutting down all the timber, you know, and saying, those who follow us can best take care of themselves. That's an American way as well. It's a global way, too. People do it all over the world. And we've tempered that over the last 150 years. And some of these folks, like Mr. Pendley, has a point of view of extractive industry that is also valid, right? And you just have to counter the excesses of that with, say, FLIPMA, the Federal Land Policy and Management Act of 1976, you counter the worst excesses of that extraction, and you get the benefits of having minerals and gas and oil and timber. It's not really rocket science.
Hmm. Let me back up and ask you just sort of a broader, larger question. How unique is this idea of public land in this country? You've described it that way, unique and wonderful, I think is also how you put it.
Yeah. I think it's one of the most interesting assets in the world, in sort of a hyper-capitalist, private property-oriented society like ours, to have this commons that was set aside over the years for reasons, too. I wish people would understand that these were the unclaimed lands after the Homestead Acts. We gave away all the land anybody wanted or could use purposefully through every one of the Homestead Acts from 1862 to 1976. We gave the railroads millions upon millions of acres. And then what was left over was this unclaimed land, or it was abandoned during like the Dust Bowl. And the federal government took over the management responsibility for the American people. And then the ones like the watershed, like the Shoshone National Forest in Wyoming, it was definitely set up very early as the first one in the West because Yellowstone needed a buffer.
Yeah.
And check this out. So one of the things that the timber industry, which was at the time of the frontier, they actually said, well, homesteaders in Wyoming are not even going to have poles to build corrals or a cabin unless we keep some of this land in federal ownership and control the amount of timber that's taken off of it. So in other words, you could be a homesteader in Wyoming in 1909, and that's the last big Homestead Act, and you couldn't go to the forest because it was owned by somebody who'd cut down all the trees, so you couldn't live there. And so I think people have missed this history as we debate this current issue of whether to privatize or transfer or get rid of public lands. Why we have them in the first place is integral to the answer that we're going to come up with. My own answer is that we've got a wonderful thing going, unique in the world. People have the ability to, every person from rich to poor has the ability to experience our own American wonder and be free and healthy and strong. And we should hold on to that. The preponderance of evidence that I've uncovered in 30 years of doing this is that this is a good thing and we shouldn't break it.
Hal Herring, he's a journalist. He's working on a book about the history of America's public lands. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking what a second Trump administration will mean for public land in Utah. Most are expecting the same kind of policies as his first term, where he reduced national monuments and rolled back dozens of environmental protections. This time around, the president seems to be influenced by an older conservative movement that took hold in the West in the 1970s and 80s, the Sagebrush Rebellion. We have with us the journalist, Hal Herring. Well, let me ask you, there's a sort of local angle here that I need to ask. You told us it was the Latter-day Saints here along the Wasatch Front who were the first to realize that this federal ownership of public land could be a good idea. Say more about that.
Well, what happened in that was, and Bernard Voto wrote about this really well, like in the 50s in Harper's Magazine, the Easy Chair column. He actually witnessed a rock slide, landslide during a snowmelt event in Utah. So the Mormons in the valley, the Latter-day Saints folks, they recognized early that if you overgrazed, over-timbered, and burned the Wasatch, that the creeks would fill up with sediment and you would not have the ability to irrigate down below. And they were some of the best at irrigating and creating what making the desert bloom, I think, of anybody in the world. And they did that kind of, it was a kind of a team effort, you know. There's a lot of great history there.
Yeah.
That the Latter-day Saints descendants should be proud of, right? It was fascinating. But they understood that what happens up above in the Wasatch in particular is reflected right there at your feet when you're trying to grow food. And what happens up there is what you get down here. And that's true of all over there at West. So they were some of the first to recognize that federal ownership, leaving those lands, not claiming those lands, letting the federal government have the ability to manage them, reduces conflict, right? So they were early proponents, and they were also early opponents once things kind of settled out.
Well, that's okay. So that gets us to the, because that's what I was going to say. Like, how does that square this early recognition of the value of this idea of the federal government having public land? How does that square with this recent effort in Utah by state leaders to get control over the, you know, now 18 and a half million acres of public land in the state? I mean, it's not the first effort, of course, but this one had a very distinct legal strategy. These leaders hired a law firm to make the case for them, and they asked the high court, the Supreme Court, to declare the BLM's ownership of that land unconstitutional. Now, of course, I think people know, and I'll just mention that the high court refused to hear that case. But how does that square with that original idea, do you think? Like, what do you make of that?
Well, things have changed. I mean, we live in a much more luxurious world, right? Like, they know now that they could own that up there. At the time, it was easier to let the federal government retain it, right, to keep it. After, you know, we have to go back to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, where we won the Mexican War, and we got all of that land, right, from Mexico. So for a long time, there was turmoil and difficulty, and people were trying to be pioneers and divest the Native Americans of their property. And at that time, it was easier to leave it in federal hands. But now, in this time of relative, like, prosperity, they are seeing, and you can't, I know there's two different things going on here with this lawsuit, but the State Lands Agency of Utah, CITLA, has really been selling off a lot of its state lands that were granted to the state at the time of statehood to support the schools, right?
Yeah.
The school trust lands. And those are being sold off quite a bit. So obviously they want some more. And that is up to a question for the American people, whether you want to give up these unclaimed lands that have become kind of America's, not playground. I mean, people use the land for grazing. They also produce minerals and stuff. But they are the property of the American people. And they were paid for by blood and treasure in the Mexican War long ago. So it is up to the American people, rather than just a court case, to whether they would want to relinquish those lands to a relatively small group of folks who plan to profit off of them and take away the freedom that we have had to do these desert trips and live this kind of American life of freedom and outdoors pursuits.
So things have changed. The sort of material circumstances have changed. Now there might be, as you say, an interest among state leaders and others to take advantage of the economic benefits of these public lands. But is there anything in the Constitution, or is there any kind of a precedent that protects the state, that land, that relationship? Or is it vulnerable, legally speaking?
So it might be vulnerable legally. It always probably has been.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you go to the Constitution, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, or the Property Clause, it specifically grants Congress the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So these lands that we're talking about in Utah were emphatically not claimed by Utah or anybody else. They are red rock. They are incredibly beautiful. They're incredibly wonderful. But you can't put pounds on cows with them. And there's nothing there overtly to dig up and sell, you know? They are unclaimed because they could not make a dollar for anybody that would also pay a property tax if you owned them. I'm fascinated by this idea that somehow there's this pool of wealth that somehow we are being denied when over and over it's been proved that these lands, they can't produce dollars. That's why they were left unclaimed.
Does the Trump administration, as far as you can tell, have a larger agenda for getting rid of public land? I mean, that's what we're talking about, or significantly diminishing it. And it makes me wonder about the effort by Elon Musk looking for inefficiencies in the federal government. Like, what would DOGE mean for land policy? Is Elon Musk looking at the Department of Interior and then maybe speculate, what would he find there that might be related to USAID in the sense that there are inefficiencies or there is waste there? Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. There is waste there, I'm sure. It's a fallible world, right? People, human beings are fallible. And human beings make up these agencies and these management. Yes, you'd find waste in public management agencies. You'd find waste in Boeing and Raytheon. There's waste in human endeavor, no doubt, and you can make it more efficient, and we should, okay? But if the person looking for waste considers, say, a healthy forest as ridiculous, they're going to say it's wasteful to have a thinning crew out there thinning, right? They're going to say it's wasteful to try, as one of the jobs that I have, plant 1.25 million sagebrush seedlings on burned over rangeland in the Owyhee, right, or in southern Idaho. They're going to say, well, who cares about that? I do virtual reality all day. Well, the truth is people do care about that because it affects aquifers, not just wildlife. So if you're not looking at ecosystem services, if you're not looking at a big picture of what public lands do, I'm sure you'll find lots of waste. I mean, you could say it was wasteful to fight wildfires. I mean, you could say there's too much interpretive ability here. There's too much wiggle room for the person watching and inspecting. We need a lot more folks at the table, which is more conflict and difficult. I realize that. But I believe that once we recognize the importance of these lands to any future that Americans would actually want for their children, then we'll have a weather change in the ideas. And ideas like Mr. Pendley's will not be totally discarded because extraction is important as well. But they will be relegated to not the dustbin, but to an earlier time of thinking when wreck it and walk on. But the fact is there's nowhere new to walk to now.
What do you, when you read chapter 16 of the 2025 project, Project 2025, about land, about what do you see in there? I mean, this is Pendley's doing here. He drafted this. And one of the things that he writes in there is no other initiative is as important for the DOI, the Department of Interior, under a conservative president than the restoration of the department's historic role managing the nation's vast storehouse of hydrocarbons, much of which he says is yet to be discovered. So you see that there. Again, extraction is part of it. But what else do you see in there? Is there any sort of legal strategy that you find in there to, again, strip away public lands from the federal government's, you know, responsibility and management? What are you seeing in the document, I guess?
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at it right now. It's like everything that they don't like that gets in the way, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service gets, like, defunded. And everything that works for, you know, give Western states jurisdiction over the greater sage grouse, recognizing that the states, you know, and the fact is there's the sage grouse lives on all the states. It's a perfect U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service species to be helping in, you know, coordinating the states, right? So everything in here is antagonistic, and it's like, delist the gray wolf in the lower 48 states in light of its full recovery. Well, I might even support that, but it's just another shibboleth. Like, here we are again. We're just speaking in these 1980s terms. Delist, get rid of, defund, prioritize my extracted activity over all others, or else I'm going to, you know, get rid of it. So here's one of the things. There's two ways that Americans can lose here. And one is what I call divestiture or divestment, which is the public lands are transferred to the states and then sold off. And I live in a state where there's guys bought 300-something thousand acres recently over in the Missouri Breaks. One of my neighbors owns 167,000 acres. The other, you know what I mean? Own and own, right? Ability of some of these wealthy folks to buy land in huge amounts has never been as high, as complete as it is now. So it would be a mistake if somebody thought that someone could not buy like the lands in Utah or the lands in Montana, the national forest. Okay, so you could lose by divestment. We could all agree that this was an experiment that just didn't work. Nobody could agree on what to do, and we just get rid of the federal public lands, most of them. Okay? But the other way is to do kind of what they did in Wyoming in the first Bush administration, which is to use categorical exclusions from environmental and wildlife laws to simply take the resources, you know, at a very high impact way. Yeah. And then those public lands are left. Like I think of Montezuma Creek in Utah, and you're just kind of left with this industrial field for the American taxpayer to try to clean up or not. So there's two ways you could lose when confronted with this ideology.
Hal Herring, good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Hal Herring. He's a contributing editor to Field & Stream magazine, also the host of a podcast for hunters and anglers on public land. He's also working on a book about the history of America's public lands. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the ideas that are shaping Donald Trump's policies about public land in the West. We talked to Anastasia Huffam of the Salt Lake Tribune this week. She's an environmental reporter there. She covers public land in Utah. And we began our conversation with her in the same way we did with Hal Herring. Does Donald Trump think or really care all that much about the issues of land here in the West?
I don't think Donald Trump spends very much brain power thinking about public land in the West, other than how much energy it can provide or its untapped energy potential. But honestly, I feel like that's even limited. I feel like what's more likely is that he has some people in his ear who are telling him that these issues matter. Mm. For example, you know, I don't think that Donald Trump took office and was immediately thinking about Bears Ears National Monument or Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
Right.
But I do think he has people in his ear and has since 2016, 2017, that these monuments or the way the public lands are managed in the West is actually inhibiting in some way American progress.
Well, you mentioned the people who might be influencing him, whispering in his ear about certain issues. One of the things we've been asking people is whether there is one thought leader in particular, you know, as we've said, like Stephen Miller on immigration, is there that person for land with Donald Trump? You wonder if one of those thought leaders might be Utah Senator Mike Lee?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely a possibility. I think Mike Lee, for a very long time, has not liked how public lands are managed in the West and thinks that there's a lot of wasted potential. And by potential, I guess I would say development, whether that be energy or, you know, real estate, housing. I think another one that I would put forward that I'm kind of been thinking about more recently, too, now that we know his pick to direct the Bureau of Land Management is Kathleen Scamma, who also wrote large portions of Project 2025. I think she has been a big thought leader behind the energy dominance part of, you know, this idea that public lands are, you know, assets waiting to be developed, waiting for their full potential to be realized. I would definitely put her up there as well. I've talked to her several times. She used to be the leader of the Western Energy Alliance, which is this group of oil, natural gas, other fossil fuel developers in the West. And this has long been a position that she's taken, is that we are not unleashing our public lands and the energy potential that they hold.
Can we just underline what you just said for listeners to make sure they understand? So a person who was used to be a part of and in charge of the Western Energy Alliance is now head of the Bureau of Land Management, yes. Which tells us something. So let's talk about Project 2025 and as the chapter that was written about land. Here's what it says. I want to read this to you. It says that President Biden's Department of Interior is at war with the department's mission, that the President Biden abandoned all pretense of complying with federal laws regarding federally owned oil and gas resources. When you see what's in Project 2025 and that kind of sentiment, that tells you what? That this is about energy, I suppose, for Donald Trump and this administration.
Yes, I think that Project 2025 tells me that. I also think that what we've seen tells me that of the second Trump term. I mean, on January 20th, he directed a bunch of Biden era conservation measures to be repealed. And, you know, not just for the heck of it, but to make those areas more available for development. Very soon after he was confirmed, we saw the newly minted Secretary of the Interior, Doug Burgum, sign some different secretarial orders asking his department to unleash American energy by removing a bunch of different barriers to oil, gas development, critical mineral development. And I think that kind of going back to what you've said about the mission of the Department of the Interior, I think there are different and interpretations of what the Department of Interior is for, what it should be doing. I think you have some people who say, yeah, this is the Department of Interior, you know, manages some of our most sacred landscapes, like truly our treasures, our gems, our national parks. I think a lot of people think the Department of Interior is about that. A lot of other people think the Department of Interior is a business and that it should be developing its assets accordingly. And I think that especially now that we've seen Donald Trump's pick for Interior, who is now the secretary, Doug Burgum, really sail through his confirmation hearing. That is the vision that's now at place in Interior, is that public lands are assets to be developed, and that conservation or kind of a hands-off approach to managing public lands is a disservice to the American people rather than a service or the mission.
What do you think about Burgum? You've said he's not like Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary under the first Trump administration. You say he's not a firebrand. He's sort of quieter. And I think you mentioned that there were a lot of, if not most of the Senate Democrats from the West who approved his. Maybe that suggests that a lot of people are thinking it could have been worse. So where does Burgum fit in all of this, do you think?
Yes, I think a lot of Western Democrats do think that it could have been worse as far as a pick for Secretary of Interior. I think also a lot of Western senators, you know, party affiliation aside, know that they need to have a working relationship with the Secretary of the Interior, no matter who it is. Hmm. I don't mean to say that, you know, a state like Maryland doesn't have public land, but, you know, their delegation is probably less concerned about how they interact with the Department of the Interior than Utah or Wyoming or Arizona. So I think that's a bit of why we saw him really one of our most uncontroversial cabinet picks. As far as like where Burgum fits into all this, so he used to be the governor of North Dakota. He has a lot to say. He has, you know, definitely he's from a big oil and gas state and he, you know, that's not exactly surprising. And he is going to bring that into his role as Secretary of the Interior. He already has. Again, I kind of mentioned some things that he signed and put in place very early into taking on his role to unleash American energy. I think that that is his biggest priority. During his confirmation hearing, before the Senate, he talked a lot about and all of the above energy strategy. You know, he's really emphasized this connection between America's ability to produce energy and our ability to withstand national security threats, like from China. He said my name in his confirmation hearing.
What does he mean when he says that we have a shortage of what he calls baseload power? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So baseload power is what we refer to. This is power that can run all the time. Yeah. Oil, coal, natural gas, nuclear. These are power plants that you can turn on and turn off whenever you want. When you need energy, you know, that you can turn on the tap. That is, you know, in contrast to renewables like solar and wind, for example, where we haven't quite figured out the storage for that kind of energy yet. Solar power only works when the sun is shining and wind power only works when the wind is blowing. So that's the difference between, you know, baseload and renewables. And Burgum has said, you know, we're in a crisis of we really need baseload energy.
Which says that the Department of Interior is probably not going to be focusing a lot of, pun intended, energy on renewables. Does that tell you that?
I would say so. And I mean, it's very well documented that Donald Trump hates wind power specifically. Yeah. He finds it unsightly. He thinks that it doesn't work as well. I think that energy is definitely Burgum's, you know, the biggest thing he brings to the Department of the Interior is this pursuit of energy and using the whole country's public lands, onshore and offshore resources, to promote American energy. He really views public lands as, and this is a direct quote from his confirmation hearing, as America's balance sheet. He says, you know, we need to, you know, be able to get a return for the American people from these public lands.
The watchword is balance. It's important we strike the right balance, he said, which means, you know, multiple uses. And this is the constant argument in the West. You've got grazing, you've got timber, you've got oil and gas mining, and then you've got, you know, conservation and recreation and how you balance all of those. And we should mention that Utah Congresswoman Celeste Molloy recently introduced this bill in the House that would repeal the BLM's so-called public lands rule, which gets at this question of balance. Explain what that rule is, and let's talk a little bit about it.
So the public lands rule basically said we want to put conservation on equal footing with other commercial uses on public land, like all those that you just mentioned, oil and gas, grazing, mining, logging, recreation. This was a really unpopular rule in Utah specifically. Utah and Wyoming actually sued over it to get it repealed. And now we see, as you said, Utah Representative Celeste Molloy, who represents Utah's second congressional district, which is most of the western part of the state. She has introduced this bill to repeal the public lands rule. And that's interesting because looping back to what we were talking about earlier about like what is the Department of Interior supposed to do? What are public lands for? You know, big question. Are they for development? Are they for, you know, balancing America's balance sheet, or are they for conservation? Are they to be conserved and preserved and enjoyed? And I think we're kind of seeing now, I mean, of course, my area of expertise would be Utah's public lands, but we're starting to see Utah's public lands vision kind of intersect and very nicely fold into the federal government's new approach toward public lands, which is this idea of conservation is already built into a lot of what federal agencies do with federal land. Therefore, we need to not, quote unquote, lock out other uses of land like ranching, grazing, recreation, mining, logging, etc.
Okay, so back in August, state leaders filed this lawsuit where they asked the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, to rule that the Bureau of Land Management's ownership of 18.5 million acres of public land in Utah was unconstitutional. Now, this was a reach. I think everyone would agree that was quite an assertion there. And of course, the High Court not so long ago refused to hear that challenge. But here's the question: could this potentially be revived in some way in the current context? How does the Donald Trump administration change what could potentially happen with an idea like that. And, you know, what are Burgum's intentions for, you know, discharging public land in the West?
I think what also made it very unconventional, other than that it was asking the Supreme Court to say that 18.5 million acres of public land in Utah are unconstitutionally held, is also what's unique is that it was filed directly in the Supreme Court. This is not an argument that Utah made at any lower court and then appealed up to the highest court in the lands. They went straight there.
Right.
And the Supreme Court said, no, we don't want to hear this. So now Utah does have the ability to file in a lower court. And I'll share with you a comment I got from the Utah Attorney General's office in late January, where I asked, you know, are you about to refile? A spokesperson for the Attorney General's office said that the office is, quote, considering all legal avenues to continue protecting access to Utah's land. The Supreme Court did not rule on the merits of the legal question. Utah is committed to the best result for our public lands, end quote. So there is definitely a chance that Utah will be filing this in another court, at a lower court at some point. But as for, you know, your question about how could this case be affected by, you know, the fact that the Trump administration is now fully in place and Burgum is now at the head of Interior? You know, I don't know how much this would affect Utah's lawsuit, mainly because this is a constitutional question.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't sued the Secretary of the Interior. They haven't sued the Department of the Interior. I do think the fact that this majority conservative Supreme Court said, we don't want to hear this case is important.
What's going to happen to national monuments in the state?
Very much perfectly in step with Project 2025. Secretary Burgum did order a review of withdrawn federal lands across the country. And that was really interesting wording because he did not outright say national monuments, but he did reference the code for the Antiquities Act of 1906.
Right.
And I realize that's really clumsy and arcane, so I'll try to explain that a little bit. But the Antiquities Act of 1906 is the legislation that authorizes presidents to designate national monuments. Utah state leaders do not like the Antiquities Act of 1906. They believe it gives the president way too much unilateral power to put away public lands, to be really pretty highly protected. And by highly protected, I mean it's a lot harder to pursue development within national monuments. So again, in step with Project 2025, which said, hey, there should be a review of national monument designations. And Project 2025 argues that presidents have, quote, abused authority under the Antiquities Act of 1906. So this is not shocking that he has ordered this review. That review was supposed to be a 15-day review of over 100 national monuments. That would have ended, it started on February 3rd, would have ended on February 18th. So as far as the information that I have, that review is done. But as far as, you know, what it's concluded or what actions will be taken from that review, how has the review been extended? No idea. It's been difficult to get in touch with the Department of the Interior on a number of questions. And so, yeah, we're just not quite sure exactly what's going to happen with national monuments. But again, if I were to hazard a guess, you review national monuments because you think, or you review withdrawn public lands because you think that there's maybe a problem with them being withdrawn. And I would not be surprised if we saw at some point some sort of similar order that we saw in 2017 to reduce national monuments in Utah and maybe in other places.
If you look at all the signs and if you sort of think about the ideas that are fueling the Trump administration's intentions for land in the West, can you at least offer some kind of guess for how you think the West could potentially change under this second Trump administration?
Yeah, I think my guess is that we're going to see a lot more land opened for developments, particularly for energy development and critical mineral development. And this is something that Trump did during his first term, you know, was trying to push through a lot of oil and gas leases throughout the West, a lot of which were met with court challenges. Some were successful, some weren't. I think we're going to see that again. I think we are going to see some interesting run-ins with how the environmental reviews and how environmental impact statements are conducted and how they impact development decisions. My shortest guess, I guess, is that we're going to see more development. We are going to see more energy development in particular. And that will have an impact on people's experiences of public lands. We're going to see public lands treated more as assets. We're going to see more active management as opposed to what Utah's leaders would call passive management, what they also call museum management, which is leave it be.
Anastasia Huffam, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Anastasia Huffam, she's an environmental reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. She covers Utah's public lands and the Colorado River. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can just email us with a comment or whatever at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.